The following is Lou Rosenfeld's talk, Beyond User Research, from the 2011 Information Architecture Summit. The 2011 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's User Experience Training Library, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. Hear the field's top experts on timely topics and the current design challenges you're facing. Get a free UIE virtual seminar at uie.com/IAS11.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Lou Rosenfeld. He's been tremendously influential in the field. If you haven't had the chance to read Information Architecture for the World Wide Web, he's one of the co-authors. It's sold many, many, many copies, over 150,000 copies. Wow. And not only that, I really think that Lou's character has infused the summit and the IA community with a particular quality that I have found very rarely other places, which is that of being open and approachable, that he's not a rock star with a rock star persona. He's a rock star who does amazing things, but you can just come up and hang out with him. And that has really influenced the tenor of the conversation and the attitude of this community. And it's why I'm part of it, is because I was able to be here and just be another one of the people at the table. So I'm grateful for that. And Lou's more recent ventures include creating Rosenfeld Media, which is a phenomenal publisher of user experience titles. You may have seen their bookmobile cruising around out in the lobby. If you haven't, check it out. We're also going to be giving a few Rosenfeld Media titles away tomorrow. But Lou wears two hats. He's not only becoming a publishing mogul, one day mogul, but right now sort of on that arc. He's also still working with organizations to help them improve their user experience, and particularly at a strategic level in how information architecture, user experience, and other things can benefit them as an organization. So he has a wide roster of clients still, and having had the opportunity to work on several projects with Lou in the past, it's certainly something that I've enjoyed tremendously. So lastly, I wanted to say thanks for Lou for kind of breaking down barriers, that same kind of attitude in the IA community of just you can walk up and start talking to people has actually spread across to other places, where I think through his influence he's tried to build bridges and to help us think more about not just our own little echo chamber, but what we can learn from other places. I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to share with us today. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, it's really nice. Thank you, Jess, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. This is home for me, which oddly is one of the hardest places to speak for me. So I don't know. It's like when I go home to my family, my parents, my brothers, I sometimes feel like it's really hard to get a word in. New York Jewish thing, perhaps. I'm the youngest of five boys. Somehow, I almost feel that way here because I feel like this whole community is, I hate the term rock stars, but really, I mean, just the presentations, both by first-timers as well as veterans the last couple of days have been amazing. So I want to do this sometime while I'm up here on stage, and I'll forget at the end. So I just want to really give a round of applause, one more, to everyone who's been involved in this event. One more time, please. All right. Thanks. Well, Jess said I like to build bridges, and I'm really not so much about building bridges, I think, but burning down silos. And I've sort of spent the majority of my career as a consultant in the post-Argus world, 10 years this month, working on dealing with large enterprise-class organizations that have these big, messy blobs of information. They're not really sites, they're information spaces, or to use a $2 term, environments, where the content is often separated by political divisions or technology or what have you, and very much not in a user-centered way. For many years, I taught a workshop on enterprise IA all about that, how to kind of make information more user-centric and tear down some of those silos. And Kevin Cheng actually commissioned him to create that graphic of me. Kevin's here somewhere, and I'd like to get him to do some more. It's time to update it, but I love this graphic. So I'm always kind of dealing with silos, but in my consulting the last couple of years, I've started to see a new kind of silo crop up that worries me. So I've been, like a lot of you, certainly as a solo consultant, when I go in to a client, I'm trying to learn something about what they know. What are their insights? What can they tell me so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So I don't have to ask them to start doing certain studies, start doing any type of analytics research, and what have you. So where do insights live when you go into an organization? It's really kind of confusing and kind of distressing because a lot of us, certainly information architects, are often working with or already part of some sort of user research team or user experience team. And so those people can kind of tell us, oh, you know, we've been doing some user studies of this sort or that sort, but it's not really enough. That's just a limited amount of the insights that are possibly resident in a large organization. In effect, what I'm finding is we have a new kind of silo to tilt at. We have silos of insight. The information we need to make informed decisions as designers of one type or another are split up all over these large organizations. And if you work in a large organization, I imagine you might be seeing this, and if you're not, I imagine you will be soon, as you try to branch out beyond the canon of user research methods that we take pretty much for granted, that we always do, because they're not enough. So this is very typical, I'm finding, when I work with clients. I get to a client, large client, and I start asking those questions. Where are the insights? And like I said, I'm often working with the user research team, and they've got their reports that they've been doing. They've been doing user studies of one type or another, as I mentioned. And that's great. I feel very comfortable, but I don't feel satisfied because it's not enough. Where else do the insights live? Well, this is not atypical. And I asked for this because I'm all about site search analytics these days. I'd like to see their search logs. And it's another group. And I'm already upset because it's, wait a minute, you've got one group of people that are ostensibly running the information architecture, but then you have search people over here. Wait a minute, these things are supposed to be together. And certainly the insights that come from them, the insights we learn from looking at what people are searching, for example, are somewhere else. It gets worse. We got the call center. I can tell you, one client I worked with, one of the first things I asked them for was, I know you got a call center. I know it's somewhere else. Could you find out if there are logs? And have those call center logs been categorized in one way or another? We don't think so. We got to ask a lot of questions and go through a lot of hoops. And in one case, it took something like 4 or 5 months working with a client and just pure dumb luck that we suddenly found someone who said, sure, I know the right people and I'll get them for you. But there's more. There's these guys, web analytics people, who are sitting on top of tons of data. And to make it more complicated, usually in large organizations, not one group doing this. There's a bunch of people working maybe with different applications. Maybe there's an Omniture installation somewhere. Maybe there's Unica somewhere else and so forth. So wait a minute. It's getting more complicated. Where am I going to find the insights that me or the organization itself needs to drive its design decisions? Then there's, this is not atypical, there's the voice of the customer people using their methods to figure out what we would call, not voice of the customer perhaps, but user behavior, user needs, or what have you. So there's all these other people. And they know something that's different. And then there's the people sitting on top of the CRM data. Now I'm getting to a point where I'm not sure I've even really seen CRM data. I'm not sure if many of us would know what it looked like if it hit us in the face. We know it's around somewhere, and it's important, and it tells us something about user behavior. Then, in a lot of organizations, there's a research center. This is where a lot of this stuff is supposed to be emanating from in the first place. These are the people that are supposed to have the insights about the future. That's a good thing to know about. But there's huge walls between some of these folks and the people that are making design decisions on the ground. And, you know, a lot of large organizations have these research centers, but yours might not still. There are insights in places that you may not own, but they're called libraries. People have done research for years that might be applicable to what you want to do. And yet we're not going out and looking for past research to inform our decisions. Even if it was not invented here, it could still be highly valuable. And then, this is actually a bittersweet thing for me. In one case, I showed up at a client and saw that they had a huge mental model, Indy Young style, on the wall. And as a publisher of that book, I was just, you know, great, great. I wasn't expecting that. But it was a different agency that owned that. They were like the people who really knew how to do mental models. And so that was already worrisome because, it's not just that the insights are fragmented in our organizations, but sometimes they reside outside organizations. And that's problematic, because if they're outside organizations, they could leave, and we won't have any institutional knowledge retained. And then in the same organization, another agency had been brought in to do brand architecture. I'd never even heard of brand architecture, but when we started looking at it, it's like, wow, they're doing a lot of interesting, different research to come up with what we people might call information architecture. And then another agency or another third party doing net promoter research, huge, unbelievable surveys that you had to go to them in order to change. For example, the NPS work that was being done with one of my clients, as interesting as it was, they asked no questions in their elaborate surveys about findability. But we couldn't change that because those surveys were residing in the hands of a third party. On and on and on. We're tilting at new silos. And again, if you're not, I think you will be. If you start looking, you probably will find them. It's bad news because what's going on here? We have these organizations that get it. They say, yes, we get user research. And let's demonstrate that by showing you that we're paying lots of money for lots of professionals who work for us or who work at our agencies or other third parties that we're employing. And they're doing all this great stuff. But nothing's coming together. They're totally overpaying. And more importantly, besides duplicating effort, they're losing out on the combinatorial effect of putting these insights together. There's your pre-chewed tweet, combinatorial effect of putting insights together. That's what I want you to walk away with. And I think it's been a nice message, actually, in some of the sessions in the last couple of days, like certainly Nate Silver, but also I heard great things about the one right before that I unfortunately missed because I was sweating in my hotel room. Okay, so we're missing out on all these great benefits from not putting all these things together. It's almost like a mapping or a cartographic challenge. Really a three-headed one. So we have this fragmentation problem, which I've already said, things live in silos, not just content, but now insights that ought to help us figure out what to do with content and other design issues. We've got differentiation. We don't really understand what that CRM stuff is about. I've never seen one of those things before, yet I sense it might be good to look at if I'm doing any kind of design work. And then, most importantly, this combinatorial issue, the synthesis of all those insights into something that approaches an organizational brain, an organizational or institutional way to make smart design decisions. So that's kind of what we're facing. In my limited experience with this, I've tried to map it. And I think a lot of us are pretty good at doing this sort of mapping of an organization and how it works. It's almost like the same sort of urge that we use that got us into doing things like sitemaps and wireframes. I came up with a bunch of dichotomies. I couldn't map it. So let me run through some of these dichotomies. What I'm finding is there's a lot of people who are really good at figuring out what is going on. And there's a lot of other people, often not the same, that are really good at figuring out why those things are going on. So for example, people draw on information that comes from analytics research, the quantitative data. They may learn something really interesting. But it's all behavioral stuff. They don't really know what was going on in a user's head. They can draw and infer interesting hypotheses, but they can't test those hypotheses. That's something that people who are really good at doing user studies, for example, like a lot of us, are really good at. We, on the other hand, aren't always so good at knowing the right questions to ask. And I'm kind of going to start focusing a bit on two areas of practice, web analytics and user research. But these are the ones I know best. This is really even more complex when you introduce all the other perspectives. But let me just focus on these two. So a lot of the web analytics people can tell you what is going on. They can't tell you why. A lot of us can tell you why things are the way they are, but we don't know what to test necessarily. We don't have the right questions to explore without the data to help us figure that out. There's a whole kind of breakdown between qualitative and quantitative people, and I love this diagram with the two brains in there. I wish I'd come up with it. I'm not sure how well you can read it, but numbers versus emotion, analysis versus empathy, the brain versus Binky, is that what it is? So, you know, we have different ways of looking at problems, different ways we try to solve problems, and we often are comfortable with different types of data or evidence to help us solve those problems, or at least to help us understand what the problems might be. So that's a big breakdown. A lot of what I'm saying right now, I'm trying to make a point, and by making that point, I'm going to overgeneralize quite a bit, but I think a lot of us kind of would fall into one of these categories. I don't know that anyone is equally comfortable with qualitative and quantitative data. I've met very few people that seem to be able to do that. In many cases, I think some of us went for qualitative studies because we're really uncomfortable with quantitative data, or vice versa. It's just sort of the nature of how our minds work and what we're comfortable with. A lot of us are in the business of making sure our organizations reach their goals. So web analytics people, as an example, they express goals as KPI, things that are measurable, key performance indicators. A lot of us in this room have been trained to think more on behalf of the user and what their goals are and how to identify them and make sure they're using them. Sometimes those things are very easy to mesh together, especially in commerce sites, for example. Often they're not. We have to resolve these things, but we're not always so good at it, because usually whoever's making the decision has a bias in one direction or the other. In effect, they're thinking with half a brain. I think a lot of us are really good at measuring the world that we know. So certainly, again, on the analytics side, you start with your KPI based on metrics, and you say, I'm going to look at all that data and figure out whether we're performing against the goals that we've set out for ourselves as an organization. Are we doing well? Are we not doing well? Contrast that with looking at data for patterns, looking at data for things to emerge that were unexpected. So that kind of emergent data analysis is really looking to learn about the world we don't know and therefore don't know how to measure. And then yet another, and I'm sure there are more dichotomies, there's a breakdown between the comfort level and understanding of statistical data versus descriptive data. And you could have people who make very strong arguments, garbage in, garbage out, in both cases. And they'd both be right, probably, in both cases. But that's not how they see it. Usually we have a bias toward one direction or another. We like one, we like the other, usually not both. But they tell us very interesting but different things that often fit together nicely, as we'll see. So I've tried to, like I say here, reduce this to a very overgeneralized, oversimplified set of dichotomies that I've just gone through. So this is just a summary of what those are. And this is just for two areas. This is just for web analytics and user experience. But if you look at these, I hope what you're starting to see is not just the differences, but the fact that they come together quite nicely, that they're very complementary. And that's where that combinatorial effect starts coming in, where the insights that one has fit quite nicely with the insights of the other. Now, I can't map this. It's just not in my wheelhouse. I bet you some of you could. What I'm really hopeful for is that someone like Alex Osterwalder, who wrote the Business Model Generation book, is anyone familiar with it? It's fantastic. He actually created and published it with a bunch of people, created a whole new business model around publishing just to do one book. Amazing. But he did a whole bunch of mapping of essentially the business models. It's oversimplified, but damn it, it's useful. We need something like that to take all these types of insights and put them together in a way that would be really useful for us, especially making design decisions. So without a map, why bother even trying? You know, if we can't map this, if this is a really hard problem, what's the value of jumping in? Well, for one, we can really, really learn quite a bit from each other's data, right? So let me give you an example. This is one of my favorite things in the world. It's a little bit of site search analytics code, a little snippet of stuff. All you really need to know is that if you look at it, the orange stuff, like Linson's plate, is what was searched. There's a few other things that you can maybe figure out, an IP address, so you know who it is, a time date stamp, so you know when it happened. The zero next to the last bit of information is how many search results there were. Now, look at another line. Same time, roughly 2 seconds later, same IP address. Now they're searching license plate, and I got, I think it's 146 results. Interesting. What's going on here? Maybe they spelled it right, but well, what happens next? It's a different user. And they're searching on a real mouthful. This is a state government site, and this user was searching that site for Regional Transportation Governance Commission. People search things that long? They know what those things are even called? Do you know what government agencies are called? as you're looking through this, I bet you each one of you are just already putting on your analysis hats and saying, you know, obviously typos are an issue. How would I fix that problem? Maybe I would turn on the spell check on the search engine. Now, did they get what they wanted when they were searching on license plate or not? We don't know. Is that a common thing that people search? And what about this mouthful in the last line? And, you know, basically, each one of us would probably have a whole bunch of different ways of looking at this data, and we would start inferring very different hypotheses. Just a couple examples. I think a lot of people from the overgeneralized analytics community would be wondering things like, are we converting on license plate renewals? And a lot of other people, like me, would be saying, what are people searching for the most? Is it license plate coming up a lot? If so, are we giving them that information very easily? Are we presenting it on the main page so they can renew their license plate easily and so forth? So we look at the same data, tiny little snippet of data, and we probably are starting to come up with different conclusions or at least different hypotheses and thinking about what we do next differently. What the next action would be could be very different if you're looking at this as an interaction designer versus an analytics person versus a content strategist. Another way we can really benefit each other is by helping improve each other's design tools. So I grabbed an adaptive path persona, and you know, again, I love site search analytics, but there are lots of other types of analytics out there that you can do this with, but I threw some site search analytics data in there. So you got your typical persona stuff, right? And then why don't we add some data? Wouldn't that enrich it in a new way? What does Steven search? Now I can actually go to my analytics people and say, I could use some of that data. In fact, maybe my personas might match up well with your audience segments. Maybe we can start putting these things together in some new and far more powerful ways. We can really help tell each other's stories. I love this example. Adaptive Path again. Jeff Veen and a team were working on a product to make analytics data more easy to understand. I think it was called MeasureMap. Is that right, anyone? MeasureMap. And Google liked it. In fact, Google basically bought MeasureMap, but they really bought the team. And they'd already purchased an analytics application that they were going to make into Google Analytics, but they wanted that team to work on it, to help tell the story of the data in a way that maybe someone from the web analytics world wouldn't have thought. So whereas a lot of analytics applications are just showing you reports, because that's what we do, we just show reports and more reports and more reports, what these guys did is they turned that on its end, and they said, reports are answers to questions. Let's lead with questions. Let's frame reports as questions. And that's an obvious duh to us, but really powerful thing that might not have happened if those people, from a UX perspective, weren't involved in the project. So we can help solve each other's design problems. Now, Jared, you're becoming the new Jacob because you have to be mentioned in every talk ever given in the user experience world. But this is a Jared story, and I hope I get it right. It's an old one. It's an oldie but goodie. Land's End. If you're not from around here, that's a big commerce site for clothing. They were looking in their search logs and finding that people were searching on product IDs, in other words, SKUs, SKUs. And they weren't finding anything, which wasn't surprising because there was no SKUs listed on the site. That information wasn't there. These things. Well, what do you do? The fix is probably pretty obvious, is you add that information to the catalog, the web-based catalog, and that's great. However, they wanted to learn a little bit more. Is there some mystery here? Why would people know our SKUs? That's kind of bizarre. It's like going to Amazon with the ISBN number in mind. It's probably not a common behavior. So it's easy to fix, but they wanted to know more. So the analytics data suggested a problem, which in this case, the hypothesis was pretty obvious, and that's the problem they solved. But they wanted to dig deeper, so they did a field study. And what they learned was, hey, people in their homes, they are referring to that nice printed catalog that they've been receiving every 2 months since they were 14 years old, you know, because the website's kind of a pain in the ass to use. But anyway, they're used to the printed catalog, and you know, it's got those high-res images. And, oh, I like that. Let me now go to the website and type in that number thing. Well, wait a minute. Now, you weren't doing that 20 years ago. You were calling the 800 number. Yeah, but then you have to deal with a human being, and they're so pushy. I hate them. Or you could send your order into the US mail, but that takes a long time, and apparently it was easier to do this on the website. So it's actually a kind of a nice illustration of a cross-channel experience, which I would call service design, but I might get in trouble for that. So just a nice example of how these things can come together and illuminate each other and give you a deeper insight, or set of insights. We could also test each other's hypotheses. So this is an example from Netflix. Now, bear with me. I know this is like probably not what you want to be looking at 5:30 on a Saturday. But this data, by the way, is based on a bunch of analytics that Netflix just threw into Excel. You will see no statistical tests. I think Nate made the point, but if you didn't make it strong enough, you can do data analysis without doing statistical tests. Okay, repeat that to yourself. You can, you should. Okay, so what Netflix is doing here is really kind of interesting. They are looking at, on the right, things that were searched. These are basically the names of movies and TV shows. So things like Click and The Departed and Thank You for Smoking and all the way on the left, sorry I didn't lay this out, they have the number of times each one of these was searched. So you're seeing the searches sorted by most common to least common. All right. So that's one hoop. They're looking at stuff that was really popular. The second hoop was then they wanted to look at stuff that was being clicked through. So which results, when the user did a search, were being clicked through? Another kind of analytics data, you know, clickstream analysis. And they were seeing that certain titles were clicked through at high percentages and others maybe not so high. Okay, and then there's the third hoop, which was were those things being added to the user's queue. So something being searched, and then okay, being clicked through, and then okay, was it being added to the queue, which is Netflix goal. That's what they want to see happen. So in certain cases, things were very successful, like Thank You for Smoking. It was searched a lot, it was a number three search, clicked through at a high rate, fairly high, and then it was added to the queue at a really high rate. All right, but then Netflix doesn't really care about where they're succeeding, they care about where they're failing. So Lost, very popular, clicked through a lot, and then added to the queue at a really, really low rate. Any theories? Well, there's a bunch of theories that, again, you guys have probably come up with. It might have been that TV shows that are multi-episode are problematic in a way that should impact the design of the way they present the search results. It could be something with the term loss. Maybe it shows up in a lot of different titles for some reason, and that confuses things. There's a lot of things that could be happening here. Maybe the availability of those items is really slow, and so maybe Netflix needs to look at that and say, oh, we need to stock more of Lost. What they do is they look at patterns like this, not just Lost, but see what other patterns map up with this or match up to this, and see if they can learn something different, that they can test out some new hypotheses. Now, if you were just an analytics person, you probably wouldn't have come up with this. You probably needed some other perspective. Maybe it was not a user experience person, but maybe it was a manager who understood the basic core of the business model of Netflix. These things have to come together in order to get good, unique insights. Okay, so this is the challenge, is getting these pieces together to work as one brain. It's not that there's just two hemispheres, there's like 20 or 30 pieces to this brain or this jigsaw puzzle that aren't really coming together. And that's what I think is a really, really fantastic challenge for us to be thinking about how we might solve. We folks are a bunch of gap fillers. We see problems like this, just like we saw problems like, I'm on this project for this web thing and nobody is figuring out how to organize the information. Oh, that's called information architecture. That's me. I'm going to fill that gap. People in this room are primarily here because we fill gaps. That's how we got here. And I think this is a key one that a lot of us are going to be dealing with for years to come. What do we do about it? So from a kind of grassroots perspective, what we as practitioners can do, well, it's tough. There are certain things we can do, or we should at least ethically be obligated to try with the understanding that we're in large organizations in many cases, we can't always succeed, which means, of course, try again. As an obvious basic thing to do, surf those silos, talk to other people. Samantha Starmer gave a fantastic talk yesterday and talked about how at REI, she goes, good Lord, she leaves her own building on the REI campus and goes over to where the marketing people are in another building and hangs out. and probably uses those really cool shoes as a great conversation piece. But she goes and talks to people. You can do that. You won't get in trouble. You may even like ask people to have lunch with you and find out what they do. Pretend you're 22 years old again and you're doing informational interviews. But do it with people in your organization who might, just might, have something to do with insights that you haven't seen. And be prepared to share what you're doing with them, of course. I'm guessing, not the only person in this room who loves, idolizes, would lie down and die for Dave Gray. So Dave Gray of X-Plane, he's known as like one of the world's foremost visual thinkers. And I was trying to resolve some of these dichotomies and figure out how to get people from different disciplines or different perspectives to talk to each other when we're not even using the same languages. We've all been in that situation. And Dave just like said, oh, well, what you want to do, of course, is create boundary objects or identify boundary objects. And boundary objects are, as you might gather, things that kind of are common to different disciplines. The different disciplines might call them different things, but they are resident in both disciplines. And therefore, they can be a source of common discussion and ultimately people coming together and understanding each other. And like a day after we got off the phone with Dave, he'd actually blogged something where he took the concept further and created what he calls a boundary matrix, which you're seeing there. But before we get into matrices, simple ideas of boundary objects would be things like goals. We in user experience might see goals very differently than web analytics people. They express goals in a quantitative way known as KPI. Hey, that's cool. We've got something in common. That's a nice starting point. Another example we've already covered. A persona might map up quite nicely with an audience segment, the kind of audience segments that they're using in the analytics world or within our companies. It's another idea of a boundary object. Can you sit down and show each other what you're doing with your common boundary objects and start looking for ways to maybe have them drive each other, meld them, improve them together in some way, maybe even combine them? So the URL for that blog posting is right there. And by the way, these slides are all up on SlideShare, although you might give me tonight to upload this last minute version because I can never finish a presentation until 5 minutes before I have to give it. An obvious thing, I mean, brown bags. You guys are doing incredible stuff. Can you present it every other Tuesday? Can you ask other people if they're interested to come join you? Who are those other people in those other silos? Bribe them. Say you'll buy the pizza. Give them an opportunity. At least try. You might get one of the 25 people you hope to have show up. But that one is going to be pretty damn worthwhile. On the other hand, I got to say, I've tried doing things like this in a more focused way with very senior blessing. And you know what happens? People say they're going to show up, and then work gets in the way. And a lot of these things I'm saying with a grain of salt, because ultimately, until people have clear incentives to share, to show up, to meet with each other, it's hard to do. So it may be that you can't get beyond the really informal things, but you can still do those informal things and not expect people to actually come together as working groups and so forth, because they may not have the blessing or the incentives from senior leadership. And that's where it ultimately comes down to. So one last thing we can do, as I said earlier, we're a bunch of really good mappers. You guys are probably some incredible mappers because you've been mapping information spaces for years, and those are really hard to map. They're multidimensional. Actually, I think a lot of what we're talking about here is not multidimensional, it's maybe two-dimensional. The hard part is just doing the legwork. And the harder part is doing the connections and synthesis that I mentioned earlier. But there are some maps out there. One I really like, Christian Rohrer has this landscape of user research methods. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen this. I think this is fabulous. It's imperfect and flawed and wonderful. So what he's doing is he has two axes. The data sources are behavioral versus attitudinal. The approaches are qualitative versus quantitative, and he has a categorization scheme in there for the different types of methods that he's mapping out. Now, if I was a web analytics person, I'd have a lot of issues with this landscape. I'd say, wait, you know, my stuff is always squeezed in the upper right-hand corner, and yet I have much more data than anybody else. Is that right? Does that make sense? So forth. So this is skewed because this is the kind of perspective that folks from our community would come up with to describe the landscape of ways you might achieve insight. However, as flawed as it could be, it's useful because now you have a thing, an artifact, to show other people and have them challenge and take you seriously in the process and draw them into the discussion. Similarly, Avinash Kaushik has his Trinity strategy. Avinash is probably the best-selling author in web analytics. And if you look at his worldview, you'll see that our stuff is, again, a tiny little piece. And he uses terms that we probably wouldn't necessarily, like voice of the customer, in that whole area of experience in the lower right. So he accords us a little bit, just as Christian accords people like Avinash a little bit. But it's a start, and these are good maps. What we need is something that takes a much broader view, and I think we can get there, but it's a big challenge. So I've been talking about what practitioners might be able to do. There are ultimately a lot of things that have to come from leadership, from those people we call decision makers. A tail can only wag the dog so far. How do we get those decision makers on board? One of the real problems with decision makers is, to overgeneralize yet once again, I don't think they take the concept of the term decision making very seriously. Because if you look at the decision making apparatuses that manifest themselves in large organizations, you would never have designed it that way. In fact, one thing I really encourage you to do, if you have the opportunity as a consultant, if you get to the C-level people or some senior decision makers, or if you're really lucky, you're someone within your own organization who gets FaceTime with very senior people, blue sky it. Ask that question. What, you are decision makers. I assume you need evidence or data to drive your decisions. Can we do a little blue sky exercise around what ideal you would have if we just were starting our organization from scratch? If we burned the whole thing down and started over again, how would we make decisions? I can assure you it would not look like what you have now, which is organic and siloed. The insights are not in any kind of logical form. The insights are locked up in applications, in disciplines, and in perspectives that don't work together. So blue sky decision-making apparatus, that's the organizational brain. How would it look? What would it be like? Would it be balanced? I would also encourage you to do something that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but I'm finding in client meetings very effective. I say we're going to ban certain terms. And when I do this, basically I say, everyone in the room, if you use some of these terms that we've banned, you got to put a dollar in the center of the table, and if I do it, it's $5, or you can make the stakes higher, whatever it is. These are the kind of terms that are useless. These are the kind of terms that are meaningless. These are crutches, but they're worse than that. They're worse than crutches because they have a negative impact. When we talk about, well, our Omniture people do this, we basically just completely gave away whatever kind of deeper understanding of what it is they really do because we've labeled them as the Omniture people. Or we talk about certain methods without really understanding what the insights behind those methods might be. So you can try something like this where you ban certain terms that people use as crutches to force the issue of thinking about what kind of insights do we need to make decisions, design decisions, and ultimately strategic decisions, because they're all melding anyway. Try banning terms. Try to present frameworks. This is mine. Again, it's overgeneralized, like every one of them will be. But this has a bunch of assumptions and questions that don't use those kind of terms I was suggesting that you ban. I mean, yes, I've presented web analytics and user experience. Cross those out. But focus on the questions. Focus on the general concepts that fit within the realm of decision making. And use that as your guide. Then you're in a position to start doing design. But a lot of you probably look at this and you see it the way I do, which is dashboards. Executives love dashboards. It's just sort of, you know, they just go together, executives and dashboards. But, you know, they're kind of a pain in the ass to design when those dials aren't all quantitative. I mean, really, the metaphor starts to fall apart pretty quickly because what we want, really, is to portray or map, that term again, our insights. We've got stuff coming in from card sorting here. We've got stuff coming in from clickstream analysis there. But then what we want to do is draw lines between them. So some of those things don't map as dials or present themselves as dials because they're not quantitative. But actually, the really interesting thing is to draw the connections between them. So we get that combinatorial effect. So this metaphor, it may be the best one you might come up with, but it's an imperfect one. Use it, but realize it's not going to get you all the way. When you put these things together, you put, really, people together, now you're really succeeding because you're getting people who are amazing but haven't been given the opportunity necessarily to work with other kinds of people. So ultimately, the framework that you need to create, it's not a map, it's not a dashboard, it's people. It really is people. It's Soylent Green. You got to get these people thinking together, give them opportunities to interact together, let them rub up against each other and bump into each other and say, hey, who the hell are you? And what do you know? And that's how it happens. So the kind of organizational decision-making brain we need to start thinking about designing, you know, we have to do some mapping, we have to do some modeling, but ultimately we have to rethink the way our organizations are structured in order to make decisions. I think we're those people. Again, we're the people that figure out what's not happening. We're the people who have those uncomfortable feelings of something's wrong here, and no one's thinking about it. And I guess I'm going to have to be that person yet again. So you've been there. You already have some battle scars, I'm sure. You're going to be there again. You're going to solve this problem, and then you're going to be on another problem. But if you're in this field, you're one person who's probably here because you see things aren't right. You may not even have a term to describe it yet, but you want to fix it. You want to plug that gap. So there's hope. You guys are it. Thanks.
Thanks, Lou. That was fantastic. We have some time for questions. We have a couple mics running in the room. If you want to ask a question, just raise your hand and wait till one of our mics finds you.
Everyone wants to go drink? Really?
Hey, Lou. Great. I'm in exactly this situation right now with a client, so this was perfect for me to hear. I just wanted to throw one little anecdote from my recent past in with this. So we were trying to come up with an app to help some people with a kind of a complicated task. And we were looking at how they were accessing the forms to do that task in current state. And so we did some site search, you know, analysis to see what keywords they were using. And what was bizarre was that we saw people were using terms that we just thought regular people shouldn't know this term. Like, people don't talk like this.
I have a book for you. It'll be out in May.
Awesome. So the cool thing, though, was is that we happened to be working with the call center, too, because they were helping to lead people through this very process. And we put two and two together and figured out that the call center associates were coaching people. Like, so people would call, and they would say, I need to do this thing. And the call center person would say, oh, you need a form. Go to the website, type in obscure word that nobody normal actually says, and it'll get you right to where you need to go. But it was only because we connected those silos kind of by accident, right? So I just had that memory when you mentioned that.
So
I
mean, how much money is being wasted by having the call center people train the users to do it wrong?
Right, exactly.
To paper over poor design.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have known that if you hadn't done that
if we
kind
had
of exploration
and
across
silos. And now it's occurring to me that like I probably could have done some more, you know, detective work and even found other stuff in other places. So this is great. Thanks.
Detective work is actually a really good metaphor. I guess it would be a metaphor for doing it. That's exactly what you need to do.
So you need like a Sherlock Holmes hat now on the picture instead of the hard hat.
Absolutely.
Maybe. All right.
Lou, I wonder, have you looked at the discipline of knowledge management and how it might lessons learned from that and brought into this sphere?
That's a good question, Bob. Knowledge management, absolutely. An incomplete but somewhat holistic effort to capture a picture of what information is in an organization that's worth keeping and how to keep it. You know, I always kind of worry about knowledge management because it seems more focused in some respects on capturing what's in people's brains rather than benefiting from what we've already captured. So I always see it as a bit of, it's useful, but somewhat incomplete. That needs to be at the table, though. You know, I think a lot of people in this room probably have some experience in knowledge management. There's a lot of overlap with IA, for certain. Probably a weaselly answer, but that's my answer. Samantha?
That was really fantastic. Thank you. And very timely and apropos to stuff I'm thinking about. We recently created a centralized customer insights team that's separate from my team. I still have the user research on my side. And on the one hand, it's really great because more people talking about insights is fantastic, but dealing with the silo problem. And the other thing we're dealing with is almost too much information now. Mm-hmm. Now that we have this centralized team who's getting time and money and funding to get new tools, how would you recommend starting to create those insights that are the ones that are the most valuable?
You know, it's really interesting. It's sort of like you're dealing with, you know, trying to have useful insights emerge from a morass of more and more stuff. It's like the world we don't know versus what I would suggest is you go back to profiling and measuring the world you do. Let me use a better way to describe this. When I have authors that are stuck, and when I'm writing, when I'm stuck, I've been writing too much or they've been writing too much and they've lost sight of where they are. They're very much in bottom-up land. And what I tell them to do is flip or switch to top-down land. So go back to your outline. Think about your structure one more time and try to fill out that skeleton. I think that's what I would do in your case. When you get stuck in one area, bottom up, you're drowning in data, go back to what your goals are and express them as KPI if you can, but go back to why are you doing this? What kind of decisions are really important for the organization to make? And center your sifting through all that stuff and your prioritization around that. Anyone else? Any other anecdotes? Olivia, right here.
Hey, Lou, can you clarify a little bit what you mean by mapping? Because I'm having a heated debate with Kevin here because we're trying to figure out if you're focusing
quietly,
on...
Quietly.
I'm sorry?
A very quiet debate. Are you tweeting this?
Yes.
Okay.
So I guess my concern was, having tried to do a lot of in-house work where I was trying to get designers more interested in data and gone through an effort to try to bring those silos down and provide all these different sources of data so that designers could become interested in that data, and coming to Samantha's problem, becoming overwhelmed with the amount of data, I found that there's a big problem in terms of spending time just mapping stuff out, mm-hmm. and spending time actually just trying to understand how do I interpret data, because this is new to a lot of designers. So it's almost like there's a threshold of, if you don't have a certain level of literacy about understanding certain pieces of data, you can just spend a lot of time mapping because that's so much more fun than trying to figure
right.
it out.
That's a really good comment. It actually makes me think of, I'm always telling people, don't do content inventories as a snapshot because it's insane. And do a rolling content inventory where you're basically sampling in an ongoing way and looking for certain things that are important because you know what's important in your content. In a way, the mapping process should probably work the same way. You need to be kind of doing an ongoing effort to kind of figure out where the insights are. You're not going to do it all at once. I'm not sure it's possible. However, I think that's where the boundary objects can really come in well, because the boundary objects, there's a handful of things that you can probably identify that might have value to other people, and get those designers to look at data, get those data people to look at design, because there's some commonality there. So in a way, it's like they're like small touch points that are high value and high priority that people can focus on together. So if your real challenge is getting people together, I'd go back to Dave Gray's work on that. That's it. Okay, thanks everyone.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2011 IA Summit. For more great user experience design content, visit uie.com and sign up for our free newsletter, UIE Tips. We'll be right back.